funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where exactly is your mind? The obvious answer for most of us is in my brain. But is that really it? Or does our modern dependence on Google to dig up information, our cell phones to recall phone numbers, even pencil and paper to work out math equations, actually extend the human mind beyond the physical boundaries of our skulls and bodies? Andy Clark is here to talk about his ideas on these questions. He's professor of philosophy in the School of Philosophy, Psychology, and Language Arts at Edinburgh University in Scotland. His new book is called Supersizing the Mind: Embodiment, Action, and Cognitive Extension. He's in town to speak tonight at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. The lecture is free and open to the public, although space is limited. The title is Natural Born Cyborgs. Andy, welcome to Think.
Hi, I'm really delighted to be here.
Let's start by clarifying the term cyborgs, because it drums up thoughts of the bionic man and the bionic woman, but that's not what you're talking about here.
No, not really. I mean, it's true that the term has that kind of history. It was introduced in the 1960s, and it was introduced as part of the space program, actually. The idea was to sort of retrofit humans to space by basically implanting stuff into them and having it controlled by cybernetic loops. That sort of notion of the cyborg as involving all wires and loops is the one that I kind of try to want to get away from. And I think that in popular culture, what we actually see is a lot of implants and sort of terminators and things like that. But when you think about what's going on there, it really seems as if it's a kind of synergy or the balance between what the technology is doing and what the biological kit does that really works. And it doesn't matter much whether something's going over a wire or coming through your senses in order to get that to happen.
So the feedback can actually go between sort of biological circuitry and synthetic circuitry, something we see online or read in a book for that matter.
Yeah, I think absolutely. In a certain sense, you know, you could imagine being hooked up to some sort of machinery that has some direct wires going into your brain, or you can actually be sitting in front of a screen and have physical energy coming off of that screen, hitting your eyes and going into your brain. It's basically messages traveling around, and what really counts is a kind of overall machine that is created by this sort of intercommunicating system.
And this is as old, obviously, as human communication. So when we learned to talk, we did this for the first time.
That's right. I think that human speech was probably the first of these sort of proto-cyborg technologies. Writing is kind of a clearer example in some way because, you know, you're creating these sort of clearly non-biological structures, scribbles on pen, and, you know, on bits of paper and so on. So I think spoken language is a sort of intermediate case where you know, we're creating something that has a kind of a solid existence outside of us that then sort of impacts our thinking in a systematic kind of way. And I think we see this in lots of other cases too. The case of gesture while you speak is one that I've been particularly interested in.
So Andy, if we've all been doing this all this time without really thinking about it, why is it important to think about the mind as more than just the gray matter within our skulls?
Yeah, I think one reason why it's useful, apart from the fact that I guess as a philosopher I think it's metaphysically compelling, but, you know, I mean, maybe it's only philosophers care about that. But I think it also matters because current technologies are sort of increasing the pace and the range of our possible cyborgy options, if you like. So instead of having kind of one or two options that are so ubiquitous that basically we don't even notice them anymore, like writing and speech, we're having, you know, I know iPhones and sort of Twitter and Google and all of the different applications that are lying around, software agents that learn about you just as much as you learn how to use them. That particular side of the new technology is where, if you like, I forgot to use the cough button,
that's
sorry.
Okay.
Where, if you like, they're learning about you as much as you learn about them. I think that that's ushering in an age of kind of more sophisticated, greater cyborgization because the kind of fit now doesn't all depend on the plasticity of the human agent. There's the plasticity of the non-human bit of the system as well.
So does that part of the system change itself, or humans are the ones responsible for changing that environment, right?
Yeah, but of course, you know, little programs that, for example, learn about your own patterns of use and then give you more of the sorts of facilities that you're using, devote more processing power to that and less to the rest of the stuff, so that they progressively deliver faster the stuff that you care about and slower the stuff that you don't care about. Those technologies are just hovering around on the horizon, and I think that they're going to look a lot more like, if you like, the way that bits of your brain get used to what the rest of your brain is doing, so that the overall thing turns out to be the balanced system that lets you do the things that you want to do.
And I'm paraphrasing here, but the question that really fascinates you is, where does the world end and the person begin? Or the person end and the world begin?
Yeah. I think you can ask that either way around. I guess one of the reasons why I think this is socially and politically and morally interesting is that it's kind of important, and I think it'll be increasingly important, to not think that the person necessarily ends at the limits of their skin, because then you might think that certain kinds of damage to the environment, for example, don't count as much as damage to your brain. You know, if I reach into your brain and do something nasty to it, the courts are going to think I've done something really, really bad. If I mess around with your software packages, the courts might not think it's quite so bad. And yet in some cases, I think we should really be treating these as equivalent sins.
You've written about this guy named, I think it's Otto, who has a sort of a memory deficiency.
Yeah.
And so what he does is he writes things down in a little notebook. And you see that essentially as that notebook is part of his brain.
Yes, I think
part of his mind,
no,
I should say.
I think part of his brain is the right way to put it, in a funny sort of sense, because the kind of idea here is that there's some physical machinery upon which you, the person, depend. In a way, that the operation of that machinery is what makes it the case that you exist. And so the claim in this paper, this is quite an old paper now, 1998 paper that I co-authored with a philosopher, David Chalmers. That paper was called The Extended Mind, and in there we had this little thought experiment of Otto, who has mild Alzheimer's, writes things down on a piece of paper and a notebook that he always carries with him. And our claim was that in some cases, like, for example, if he's trying to remember the address of MoMA, the museum in New York, then just as an ordinary agent would in some sense have to retrieve the information from biological memory and then go, so Otto automatically retrieves the information from the notebook and then goes, we wanted to argue that there's no principled reason for thinking that before the act of retrieval, the normal agent knows where the art museum is and Otto doesn't.
Hmm. So it's interesting because we all do this in a way. The fact that people no longer remember anybody's phone numbers because it's programmed right into the telephone is sort of the same kind of use of technology.
Yeah, that's right. Although, of course, I'd have to be careful about the way that you put it. You know, mm-hmm. If you say people no longer remember the phone numbers because they're programmed into the telephone, I really have to sort of sit here and say, well, what you're pointing out there is that there's a vulnerability to a bit of the equipment there mm-hmm. at the moment. And so, you know, often we might lose our telephone and then we think, oh, I don't know the number. Now, something similar can happen in the bio case. You can have a sudden brain lesion or something and suddenly, you know, you don't remember things that you knew before. The reason that we differentiate the cases properly, I think, is just because of the increase in reliability that we currently have with our biological access and memory. But suppose that, for example, that all of the information about phone numbers like that was ubiquitously available, being transmitted to all kinds of devices, so that even if you lost your phone, you wouldn't even notice that because, you know, another device would immediately take its place. Then I think, the kind of general thought is it's access that counts and we shouldn't worry about location. Location only makes a difference insofar as it's making a difference to robustness, to access, to all of these other properties.
Well, there are people who really buck against this idea of dependence on anything other than what's inside of our skulls, the whole Google makes us stupid theory.
Yeah, that's
what
right.
do you respond to that?
I think it swings and roundabouts, and it always has been. You know, we had debates like this, apparently, you know, I'm not a historian, but when writing was invented, there were many sort of rather heated debates about whether the upshot of this would be that people wouldn't know things properly anymore. They wouldn't have to learn things by rote in the way that was so important to really understand in anything. I think clearly what we've seen is that the balance of activity that the biological brain is doing compared to other stuff changes, but I think the overall effect has been an enhancement in what human beings can actually do. And on the whole, that's what we should be aiming for. But every technology has its sort of upside and its downside. The same is true, I think, for anything you do internally. You know, if you train up a bit of your brain to be really good at something, in order to be really good at it, it's basically got to give up being good at certain other things.
So if we can leave behind a record of things that took place in our minds, whether by writing or maybe you make a DVD or something, is that a kind of immortality?
Oh, yeah, that's a different sort of different issue, but it is one that lurks around here. And it's tied up with some issues that I try to skirt a little bit, which are issues to do with consciousness. So people have often asked me about this sort of extended mind story. Well, does that mean that your conscious experience might have as part of its machinery stuff that is outside of the biological agent? And as a matter of fact, I don't think that's the case. I think that everything to do with my conscious experiences has as its machinery the stuff that's internal to me. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for this. It is to do with the need for very, very tight temporal binding of events for them to get into conscious experience. At least this is an argument that I use here. So I think that the extended mind story is really a story about the extended unconscious mind. So, you know, there's an awful lot that goes on that makes you who you are that is going on unconsciously. And the position that I want to defend is, and as regards those sorts of things, there's no reason to think that they all have to be going on in the head.
What makes human minds so special as compared with all the other animals in the world?
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to that question. In fact, I think that if science knew the answer to that question, we'd be in a fantastically better position to do all kinds of things right now. The one thought that I tend to buy into here, and it's a thought that I think it's Merlin. I think it's Merlin Donald, or is it Donald Merlin? This is one of these authors whose names go one way or the other, and I always forget which. But anyway, in a book called A Mind So Rare, I'm pretty sure it's Merlin Donald, has written a kind of argument to whose conclusion is that part of what's unique, at least about human minds, is our ability to build very complicated structures of skill, one on top of the other. So you can see that, for example, we can put ourselves through training regimes to be able to do things like, drive cars and pilot aeroplanes and things like that. We can't get non-human animals to do that. Part of the story there has something to do with language, and part of the story seems to have something to do with just this general ability to build vastly sort of nested and hierarchical sets of skill structures, one on top of the other. Probably the fact that we have language and can give ourselves instructions and give others instructions is part of what leads us through a training regime to let us do that. But I think that's one of the big differences.
Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that we know that other animals communicate with one another. We know that they can solve problems and to maybe a limited extent compared with us, they can think, but they don't innovate necessarily.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I don't quite know what we'd be looking for in a way.
Well, a beaver builds a dam, but they're all pretty much the same, aren't they?
This is where I think one would really like to be a cognitive ethologist, to know the precise details of what the variation is there. You know, if a beaver encounters a slightly different sort of environmental situation to the normal one, can the beaver dam building adapt in some way to that? But I think I'm on board with the general thought that there's something that looks like a sort of great leap of creativity that we see in human history, where we don't see anything like that in other animals. And I suppose that I think the reason there has, again, to do with public language and maybe something to do with the way that public language, I think, has allowed humans to become conscious of their own thoughts. So not just to have thoughts, but to know what thoughts they're having. Because, you know, we express our thoughts in words and they become objects about which we can have further thoughts. And so now little bits of our thinking become things we can think about. And we can think about them in group settings too. I can ask you to think about this little bit of the problem that I was thinking about before that I got stuck on.
Let me have you stop right there. We're going to take a quick break. Andy Clark is my guest. He's speaking tonight in a lecture entitled Natural Born Cyborgs. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Andy Clark. He's professor of philosophy in the School of Philosophy, Psychology, and Language Arts at Edinburgh University. His newest book is called Supersizing the Mind, Embodiment, Action, and Cognitive Extension. He's in town to speak tonight at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. That lecture is entitled Natural Born Cyborgs. It is free and open to the public. Also, if you are a Second Lifer, you can experience the lecture in Second Life. You can check all that out. We have a link to it on our website, the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join the conversation now, ask a question or make a comment, we'd love to hear from you by phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@KERA.org. Andy, what are human brains really good at, and where do we need some help?
Yeah, that's actually a very important question in this area, I think, because basically what we want our technologies and this sort of web of stuff that we wrap around ourselves to do, I think, is complement what the brain's doing. In general, we don't want to repeat it because there's really not much point doing that. So I think a good clue as to what human brains really are good at comes from work in artificial neural networks, where it really began to look in the sort of, this was work that was really coming to fruition in the early 80s. But the kind of general idea is that brains like ours are very, very good at learning about patterns, fantastically good at learning about patterns in all kinds of domains, patterns in physical action, patterns in structures that we encounter in the world. We're good at sensing and acting, which is sort of what you'd expect because, you know, we're evolved biological organisms. So I think the sort of bottom line is we're good at Frisbee and we're bad at logic. we're not very good at, you know, holding a lot of stuff in mind simultaneously, seeing exactly what follows from what, you know, as a philosopher and sometime teacher of logic, I know just how hard it is to do that stuff. So one thing that, that clearly the development of external technologies like writing, for example, has done is allowed us to kind of slow things down a bit so that we can really concentrate on what follows from what. And in general, I think we see this with, say, the example that you gave earlier of remembering phone numbers. One thing that biological brains have a nasty habit of doing is merging information. So if I know a phone number and then I learn another one that is very similar to it using my biological system, I might forget both of them, just sort of merge them a bit. That's not going to happen in most of our non-biological systems, and so the complementarity there does us a great deal of good.
It's remarkable how we have figured out ways to modify our environments and enhance what we're able to do without really giving this, and maybe until you and your colleagues came along and started thinking about it, much conscious thought.
Yes, I guess that's right. And also, in a way, it would be nice to believe that giving it conscious thought made us do it better. I don't know about that. An awful lot of our best sort of tools and technologies seem to come on the whole out of a kind of rather brutal process of trial and error. You know, we create things, we don't know quite what they're going to do. People start using them for something. A whole new sort of new kind of cognitive niche begins to emerge. Think about text messaging. Who would have ever guessed that it would be as useful as it is for the kinds of things that it is useful for? But I guess there is some hope that, that as we really try to understand sort of, you know, basically human-machine interaction of one kind and another, we might be able to design environments to scaffold thinking better and better.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go on the phones now to Corey in Dallas. Hello, Corey.
Hi. This is Corey calling from my supplemental cyborg brain, my iPhone. I just wanted to see what you might have to say about the ideas of Donna Haraway, like what she has to say in the Cyborg Manifesto.
Yeah, I have. I've read and very much enjoyed the Cyborg Manifesto. Donna Haraway has a sort of interesting kind of a sort of post-feminist take on cyborgization. Sees it as a kind of a sort of very liberating. A kind of liberating possibility that sort of shows us that we mustn't too firmly identify ourselves with sort of, you know, one slightly arbitrary set of biological equipment, for example. And I completely buy that. You know, I think that what we're learning is that all kinds of things to do with our embodiment, our sexuality are actually essential but maybe more negotiable than we thought they were.
What accounts do you think for the reaction that a lot of people have, negative, to the idea that somehow our minds are beyond our brains?
Yes, I don't know. I think that some of the negativity, actually, funnily enough, I don't get much negativity,
really?
So it's sort of hard for me to really lock into that. But sometimes people think that it must be a sort of closet way of being non-materialist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's this kind of idea, oh, well, if you don't think it's all in the brain, what do you think? Do you think it's kind of spirit stuff floating around or something?
And that's not what you're arguing
and
here.
And that's certainly not what I want to say. What I want to suggest is that it's all physical stuff. It's just that, you know, some of it's wetter than the rest of it.
What about two-way human communication? Is that the same thing?
I think it can be. So, again, everything turns on the sort of overall balance that is achieved. So I think if you, for example, if you have two people that very often work together on a certain kind of scientific or other problem or an arts problem, whatever it is, those two people's brains can become so attuned to the presence of the other one and the kind of stuff that the other brain is good at, that they can begin to sort of dovetail what they do to the reliable availability of what the other one does.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this in various teams of philosophical co-authors, for example, always write together, you know. And in those sorts of cases, I think the larger machine temporarily spans two people. You have kind of overlapping minds, if you like. But I don't think that's true in every case. You know, if I just meet someone in the street and start tossing around ideas with them, then I don't think that the balance is in place there. There's not the right sort of dovetailing. So it's more like two machines communicating rather than two machines temporarily overlapping.
So that overlap is a wonderful thing. Is there like a sort of dissonance when we disagree with what another machine or some technology is telling us? How does that play out?
Yeah, clearly that can happen, although again the way that you phrase that is obviously delicate from the extended mind perspective,
mm-hmm.
because that sort of says, oh, I am the biological bit and I am here disagreeing with the non-biological bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the biological bit is a fairly fragmented thing too, and you know, sometimes I can kind of think I remember something biologically and then I think a bit harder and I think, no, maybe I just sort of made that up, maybe I'm not really remembering that. And I think we have the same sort of relationship with the stuff that we sometimes access from non-biological kits. So, you know, something comes back from a Google search and I think, do I really believe that? I'm not so sure about that one. So a lot of issues about trust. Mostly when something sort of comes back from our biological kit, we trust it. And I think it's only when mostly we trust what non-biological kit is giving us that the kind of overlap possibility is in place.
So we talked about what the human brain is particularly good at. What are our devices and our tools and our technologies particularly good at?
Well, one thing, the kind of holding things apart, so mm-hmm. holding individual facts that are kind of quite closely related, so like the phone numbers example. They're also very good, I think, at doing what's really a sort of different kind of pattern discovery. So think here about sort of collaborative filtering techniques, like the sort of common thing that you see in Amazon, people that bought this, bought that,
mm-hmm.
people that like this, like that. It's an incredibly powerful technique where you're sort of crowdsourcing new knowledge. So it's as if all we humans have become kind of trail-laying devices. And because our technologies can spot where those trails overlap, we can sort of generate automatically lots of new data and information just from our own activities. So that's another thing that I think machines are really good at. They're good at crunching massive amounts of data together, although human brain's pretty good at that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're fantastically good kind of statistical engines.
What's really interesting about that, Andy, is that, you know, if we go back to the Amazon example, if you've seen enough of those, even if you haven't done a survey of 10,000 people who bought a certain book, you start to be able to generate in your own mind, you can anticipate
mm-hmm.
The next book that somebody might want to buy, even if you don't have that information, because you've seen 10 of these things and what it suggests for you to buy next. And you can sort of figure that out without
mm-hmm.
maybe the accuracy of,
mm-hmm.
of the Amazon engine, but you still sort of mm-hmm. can guess on it.
Yeah, I think that's right. So that shows, I guess, that I can fall into the trap just as easily. The biological bits of us
uh-huh.
can learn new skills out of these sort of constant interactions with the non-biological bits too.
Can you talk for a minute about clocks? Because it occurred to me that we don't have to think about time because we have clocks to think about time for us.
Yeah, there's an anecdote that I sometimes use in this sort of area, which is, you know, someone asks you what time is it, Oh, sorry, I got that wrong. If someone says to you, do you know the time? Mm-hmm. You'll typically say yes, and then look at your watch. You don't say something like, no, hang on, and then you look at your watch. And that, I think, is a kind of microcosm of the way that we treat access as knowing, in a sense. You know, what it means to know something is basically to be able to access that information reliably and robustly on demand. Think about a case like you're knowing what month this is. You know, it's not because you're going around consciously thinking to yourself all the time, October, it's October, it's October. Instead, you know, you think that you know what month it is because you know that that's the kind of thing you know and that you can retrieve from biomemory at will. And I think that our relationship to some non-bio bits is a bit like that, and the time example is rather a good one.
So the tools and technologies that we share, do they represent a kind of collective intelligence?
So there's a sort of second issue there about whether there are collective intelligences over and above the sort of agents. So the kind of line that I guess I'm mainly pursuing is one that says the agents themselves can be extended. So, you know, the agent that is me isn't just the biological stuff. It's kind of, it slightly overlaps with certain select aspects of the non-biological stuff and maybe with certain select aspects of other people, as you were saying. Then there's this further question about whether in addition to all of the agents, whether they're made of sort of hybrid stuff or just bio stuff, there are collective intelligences. I don't know quite what hangs on that question, I suppose. You know, if it was a question, are there collective consciousnesses in addition to the individual consciousnesses, I'd think I don't see any evidence for that. If there were, then that would be morally and politically important because it would mean that some of these collectivities would have the sorts of rights that we expect individual agents to have. And so, you know, you shouldn't disband one of these collectives. I don't really see the evidence for that. And so when stuff like that isn't in question, I'm not quite sure what hangs on it. If the question was something like, can these collectives do stuff that none of the individuals in them can do, for sure.
Mm-hmm. But do they mean anything if there's no human interaction with them, if these actions take place and no mm-hmm. human is affected one way or another?
Oh, these would be... So you were thinking here of collectives that don't even have humans in them. Is that right?
I'm not exactly sure how I'm trying mm-hmm. to ask this, but it's almost if a tree falls in the woods and mm-hmm. nobody hears it, does it make a sound? Does that make sense to you at all? In other words, if something is taking place by a sort of non-human agent that we have given the power to cognate mm-hmm. somehow artificially, if that never comes back and affects a human life, what's the significance of it?
I don't think it would be significant, yeah. You know, imagine a little stock market agent out there somewhere, some little piece of software goes out, buys something on the stock market, sells it again. It hasn't made any difference at all to the overall trends, just imagine. I don't think that, I mean, that's just something happening, as you say, like a tree falling in the woods or something like that.
I wouldn't say this is something that causes a great deal of hand-wringing, but there are people who think, what if the internet gains an independent consciousness? Or what if it has it already? First of all, do you think that's complete nonsense?
I think over the years I've come to think that nothing's complete nonsense. but I don't really see it as a live danger. I mean, one reason there is that it seems so much as if being an intelligent system is so tied up with perceiving and acting in the world in some way. Everything at least that we recognize as intelligent seems to be a sort of mobile perceiving acting system of some kind. And I suppose that if you squint a bit at the internet, you can kind of imagine something a bit like that. You can see it as sort of taking inputs here and there and sort of performing actions. It doesn't really move itself around unless you get very metaphorical. Mm-hmm.
And all those actions ultimately are based on some command that was given by a human being, right?
I suppose so, but I don't think we should take that too far. I mean, there are programs out there that have already discovered interest in things in mathematics that no human had discovered before. There are programs that produce pieces of art that at least humans find interest in. Mm-hmm. These programs, unfortunately, themselves don't have the ability to as it were, find something genuinely interesting because they're not conscious agents. But certainly, you know, I think we're well past the stage at which our best sort of computing technologies can discover things that are genuinely interesting and would have been regarded as real signs of creativity had a human done so.
So can our mind-extending technologies be better than we are alone?
Yes. Certainly I think that the hybrid systems that are created when we sort of scaffold our good-at-frisbee brains with this sort of good-at-other-stuff techno-environment, those larger systems are certainly better in some ways than the unaugmented biological bits. If our gauge of betterness here is sort of ability to solve certain classes of problem, I suppose one might have all kinds of different ways of carving the cake of betterness here.
Do you work with undergraduates?
Yes, sometimes.
How do you introduce this concept to someone who's 17 or 18 years old? And is it easier almost with a younger person than with someone who thinks they understand the world?
Yeah, I actually think, undergraduates normally find the extended mind line so obvious as to hardly be worth the sort of mini philosophical industry that's growing around it.
Because they were born to it?
Yeah, I think in part maybe just maybe sort of, so many movies over the over the years that have cyborgs of one kind or another in them. It's a very small step from the notion of a sort of a fully attached cyborg where you've got some non-biological bits but they're kind of directly wired to your brain, mm-hmm. to the idea of one that is like that but the communication's wireless. After all, imagine if, for example, someone was sort of adding a little bit of external memory to enhance their laptop, and someone said to them, that really enhances your laptop if you plug it in the USB stick. But if you communicate wirelessly to something that does exactly the same storage, that wouldn't count. Well, they think, that's crazy. It's the mode of communication can't be what matters.
Yeah. Andy Clark is my guest. He's professor of philosophy in the School of Philosophy, Psychology, and Language Arts at Edinburgh University. His latest book is called Supersizing the Mind, Embodiment, Action, and Cognitive Extension. He's in town to speak tonight at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. That lecture is entitled Natural Born Cyborgs. It is free and open to the public. You can join us now at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is philosophy professor Andy Clark. His latest book is called Supersizing the Mind, Embodiment, Action, and Cognitive Extension. He's in town to speak tonight on Natural Born Cyborgs at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. The lecture is free and open to the public, also available online to Second Lifers to experience it that way. So you can check out a link to that information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. A listener writes, please define what a mind is.
Oh, that's a tough one. And I can't, basically. I don't think there is a definition out there of what a mind is. In fact, one of the really, really tough issues that the whole extended mind story seems to have raised is what makes a process count as a mental or a cognitive process. So, we have some processes like digestion, and we don't think that those are mental. We have other processes which are going on in the brain. We think that those are supported mental processes. One thing that the things that support mental processes seem to have in common scientifically seems to be that they involve transformations on representations. So information gets represented, and then there are transformations upon that representation that kind of systematically track something that is important. So simple examples, I guess, are the transformations from one sort of logical expression to another that can be shown to be truth-preserving.
Is neuroscience helpful at all?
It's wonderfully helpful, but it's not, I think, able to answer really difficult questions like the one that has been sent in there, like mm-hmm. what is the mind? One thing, I mean, neuroscience could just assume that what the brain does is what the mind is and then tell us what the brain does and say, okay, now I told you the answer, but that would just beg the question against the sort of story that I want to investigate. In general, I think that we have to take it for granted that we have an intuitive grip on what kinds of behaviour are, at least on the face of it, evidence of a kind of mind behind the behaviour. So flexible, adaptive behaviour is really important. If you find a system and it just keeps doing the same thing when you give it the same input, then it's probably not an intelligent system. An intelligent system ought to be able to respond differently on the basis of, for example, its recent past history and so on.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. You know, so often science fiction helps us imagine or even predict the direction, the way that human beings interact with technology. Except recently, especially in our culture, we don't seem to be doing such a good job at imagining the way technology is going to look, say, 50, 60 years. We did such a good job in the 60s with Star Trek, and we seem to be growing faster than our imaginations. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that. Thank you very much.
I think that's a really interesting comment. I think in part this might be just because the things that our technologies have turned out to be so good at weren't things that we perhaps anticipated in the first place. Things like these abilities to do sort of collaborative filtering, so that you can sort of find out what the sort of major lines in massive bodies of data were, and so on. I don't know quite how well we really did back there with the sort of Star Trek stuff and that. You know, most of the sort of science fiction when I was a kid, but I guess Star Trek was just a little bit after that, wasn't it? But, you know, there was all the stuff about jetpacks and sort of, you know,
teleporting
living in
oneself.
Space and teleportation, all of that kind of stuff. And we haven't seen any of that. What we've seen is this massive explosion of technologies that seem to complement what we do without absolutely sort of transforming the way that we live physically, I think. And I think we're probably going to see more of that. And whether there's some chance of a new wave of science fiction is a little bit kind of more prescient, I don't know.
We have an email here from Greg in Richardson who wants to know what you think about emergence, where a group of people might reach a better decision than most individuals.
Yeah, I think that definitely happens. And there can be various sorts of explanations for that. I suppose that some of the most obvious cases are ones where, you know, each individual might have access to slightly different bodies of information. Left to their own devices, each one would come up with the wrong answer, but when they all get together, they get the right one. There's some legal results that sort of bear that out. On the whole, I think that it's almost as if emergence is too cheap. We see it everywhere. It's almost as if everything looks a bit emergent. So, you know, the only system in which there wouldn't be anything that looks like an emergent property would be one where the contributions of the bits simply add up, you know, in a sort of a really sort of brutal kind of way, and there are no what you could think of as non-linear interactions between the contributions. And there's really not that many systems that are like that. So I think emergence is a general fact about most of the physical world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Kent in Dallas. Hi, Kent.
Hi. Well, it sounds to me like you were already addressing the topic that I was wanted to address in my question, which is the issue of mind as an emergent property of the brain. And since I didn't quite hear everything you said, I hope I'm not repeating.
Sure.
But My specific question was, can the brain, if it were an emergent prop, or the mind as an emergent property, feed back onto the physical brain substrate, particularly on the level of perhaps quantum effects of electrons and things like that, and kind of the implications of that for free will? Do we really have free will or not?
That's one of the big questions coming up at the end there. Let's take the first bit of that first, the thing about about emergence in the brain. Certainly, I think as a complex system, and indeed one of the most complex of all the complex systems, the brain is going to exhibit massive amounts of emergence. There's one thing we know about the structure of the brain is that the sort of the feed-forward connectivity is vastly kind of outweighed by the recurrent feedback connectivity. And that feedback connectivity means that there's massive amounts of sort of nonlinear effects, basically linking later and early processing all the way through. So the brain's a wonderfully engineered system for emergence to occur in. That certainly there's a sense in which something that looks a bit like what philosophers have sometimes called downward causation might occur in a system like that. I guess you have, in a mild sense, you have downward causation in any system where a sort of global property then feeds back and changes the low-level properties that started constituting it. So think about even emerging sort of thermal currents in a heated oil. As you heat the oil up, currents start to form, which actually sort of push molecules around in the liquid that change the things that are getting heated up, so you get a sort of increase. And that's sort of like the pattern that starts to emerge makes the pattern that's starting to emerge even more. And so that's a kind of top-down, sort of downward causation effect. And I'm pretty sure that we see that, as we start to sort of solve a problem, then lots of things will begin to start behaving differently that help us solve the problem even more. And so that's a sort of version of that. Has that got anything to do with free will, the other part of your question? I think, strictly speaking, I don't believe in free will. I think we're just very, very complicated systems that respond to inputs. We learn, we change what we do, so because of that you might give me the same input, next week, and I'll behave very differently to the way that I behaved this week, but not because something very magical like free will kind of got in the middle, but just because I was a complicated system and maybe...
Different stimuli, different information.
Some of the things that happened last week, maybe I didn't enjoy very much, and so I've kind of, my wiring has automatically altered itself a bit so that when I get in that situation next time I won't do the same. This is a sort of Daniel Dennett line on free will. He's got a lovely little book from years ago called Elbow Room, The Varieties of Free Will Worth Wanting. And it's sort of like, what more could you want than just the ability to do better next time? And systems where there's nothing non-physical or extra going on can do that.
Do you think the technologies that we've created to, if not enhance, at least complement what we can do, have actually changed our brains as we've evolved?
Well, I think that some of them have. So I think that reading, for example, has effects. But a lot of things are happening on timescales that are too quick.
Mm-hmm.
It's also true that, in a way, because our brains are so wonderfully plastic, it doesn't actually matter that much whether something gets changed at the sort of where you start from level, or whether we just build environments in which new brains are going to be reliably trained in different ways so that their structures will end up being different anyway. In fact, I think that that's this sort of cascade of designer environments in which we sort of culture and nurture new human brains is really what's changed us most of all. So I think that the kind of the cognitive upshot is different generation by generation by generation, even if the sort of base genetic place where you start from doesn't vary.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Richard in Mansfield. Hello, Richard.
Hi. I was wanting to know what he thought about the idea that the merging of the human with all these new technologies might be like, if we don't have the technologies, then we're sick, like, or wounded, mm-hmm. like my sons act when their phones don't work or they don't have access to the collective that is Facebook.
Yes. Swings and roundabouts, really, because I think that it's simply true. This is one of these things that we have to live with in that sort of way. Think about, for example, what happens when you take electricity away from a city. people suddenly are no longer able to cope in many ways. And I think that we can't really insulate ourselves from that. It would be like trying to insulate yourself by giving up on all of the projects that you could normally do, because you would only have to be able to take on projects that the naked brain can do on its own, you know. And it's not going to be many projects like that, you know. I'm pretty sure that my naked brain would never have managed to, you know, get the flight schedule sorted out and find my way to Dallas from Edinburgh and, you know, cope with losing passports along the way and all kinds of stuff. So I think we can't afford to shrink ourselves to the point where the naked brain can do everything that we need to do. So we just have to live with it and try and make our technologies as robust as we can.
I have to ask this, Andy, because this is such heady stuff, and pardon the pun. How did you come to this as your life's work, as the questions that you wanted to answer with your entire career?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that my life's work's over yet, so I might even do something else in the end. But the background really is that I started working in classical artificial intelligence. So as a philosopher, I was very interested in that. My first job was in that area. And that's when artificial neural networks came along. Mm-hmm. And they hit the scene, and they looked to me much, much more interesting than the classical systems that I'd been looking at. Because actually the artificial neural networks had more of this sort of good at frisbee, bad at logic property.
Mm-hmm. More like us.
Exactly. And then, of course, people start to say, yeah, but these artificial neural networks, they're just not good enough. They can't do all kinds of the things that we really want systems to do. And therefore, some people were saying, they can't be good models of what brains do. But I thought, no, that, and I'm not the only one that thought this, you know, a few of us thought, look, that can't be right. Really, what the classical models were doing was taking what the brain did in its kind of reliable environment of all this other sort of stuff and hallucinating that that's what the brain did. Hmm. And what I think the work in artificial neural networks started to do was give us a better handle on what the brain's contribution is. And that really threw into stark relief, for me at least, the importance of the contribution of the other stuff. And so that's a sort of historical route into it. And I don't think much in the big picture sense has changed since then. We've learned an awful lot about what the brain is doing, but it still seems to be in that sort of ballpark. I think there's a more sophisticated story to tell now than the sort of early connectionist, as they were called, story.
So enough to keep you busy for
but enough
a
to
while
keep
to
us
come.
Busy, you know, yeah.
Andy Clark is professor of philosophy in the School of Philosophy, Psychology, and Language Arts at Edinburgh University. His new book is called Supersizing the Mind. He will be speaking tonight at the UTD Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. The lecture is entitled Natural Born Cyborgs. It is free and open to the public. You can also access it online if you are a second lifer. Andy, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you all, and thanks for the questions. They're great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.